acceptable attitude towards the whole subject of sexuality and women, to take it seriously, to address the real issues with more depth and less sensationalism. But also, I think our work is cut out for us as activists and producers on the educational front. It seems clear that making sexual information inaccessible isn't the answer to sexual ignorance and fear. And there's an absolute dearth of sexual information in BC. Sex education in the schools is virtually non-existent. We need to take up the struggle to develop that education. I just want to add that, point out that I think in the last 6 or 7 years in BC, sex education in the schools has decreased dramatically. It used to actually exist in a few of them, and now it's almost totally non-existent. That means also looking at what materials are offered as sex education as well as where. Most sex education materials stay within a very safe parameter of morally acceptable information. So if we have plenty of work to do on the kind of materials available, the places where they are available, and the manner in which they're presented to young people. There is more than just sex to teach children about, of course. We need to be educating girls in assertiveness, in ways to prevent their own victimization. And this has begun in some degree in BC. But we also need to be educating boys to find nonviolent ways of dealing with aggression. And obviously, children are not the only ones in need of sex education. We could be developing sex education, sexual consciousness raising, if you want to call it that, for adults, sexual discussion groups, workshops, conferences like this one, through community groups and community organizations. This kind of education might begin to have an impact on the kinds of sexual consciousness and relations we see in the future. Having proposed all these ideas, I'm left with many doubts about the enterprise. Our voices are faint against the monumental power of a huge industry. In the case of the visual media we produce, we're still bound by the limits of representational dimensions. We're left with the difficulty that sexuality is a personal experience, often private and intimate, involving all our senses, and we're dealing with forms that make that experience into something else, a public event. Nevertheless, for those of us in North America at this time, there may be at least some overlap in our experience, so we try to make some collective sense of it, socially, politically, and personally. We will certainly not find one truth, only get closer to an understanding of who we each are and how we touch each other. But out of that, we can also know something about this moment in history and how to move forward in it. Sexuality is something about which we are only learning to speak from our point of view as women with a variety of sexual experiences, patterns, and preferences. We will necessarily have moments where we fail to represent accurately or faithfully, where our efforts seem inadequate, embarrassing, crudely unable to reflect or expand the nature of the experience. But there is much we have to say to each other, and so little that has been said up to now, I would hope that we can talk and listen to each other in the spirit of exploration, rather than one that further prescribes us into another corner. What I want is an ongoing conversation that explores the uncharted territory and meanings of sexuality. I want to see not only violence against women, and not only orgasmically fulfilled, happy, liberated women, but all of the contradictions, subtleties, and movement in between those extremes. Thank you.
Amber, you want a little more light? Huh? You want more light?
More light? I might need it when I'm reading.
Okay. I guess it's going to be a little bright, but can we have the fluorescent lights?
Or this one, if they can hit that spot.
Or either that, if somebody wants to climb up on a chair and get that.
She can switch spots with me and then she can get the light.
Look over.
Can you reach it?
Yeah, sure.
Apparently,
currently there's a blue Volkswagen parked in the Women in Focus parking spot, and Jillian asks that if that belongs to anyone here, if they will move the car because she has to get in and out of that space. There's a blue Volkswagen parked in the Women in Focus parking spot in the back here, and they need to be able to get in and out of that space to. Hello? So if anybody has a blue Volkswagen, will they please move it from the Women in Focus parking lot?
Yeah, we'll work on it.
Question is, when I start talking, will it start up again? Yeah.
It's waiting.
Yeah, I can tell. Everything's waiting. Could you turn the other two mics off, and then maybe there won't be such a feedback problem? I'm just going to start. It seems okay. My name is Amber Hollibaugh, and I'm from New York City, and I'm one of the people that the conference organizers brought up. And I want to try and talk about my own relationship to this issue, how I got involved in it, and what's happened to me in the process of trying to think about it. And I want to preface what I say by also saying that my experience in the United States is very different than what I feel about what's happening in this room, at least so far today. There's at least a sense that I have of the different ways that people are nodding or not nodding that's not so mean-spirited as the debate has been in the United States. And I can only say that is absolutely the prerequisite for anybody involved in this issue, is the protection of the person sitting next to you, because none of us know very much. And that seems to me to be the starting place, whether we're artists or we're sexually active or not, or we're feminists or wherever we're coming from, because the other thing is I don't have a clue about who's in this room. Looks real different to me depending on, I mean, I see people nodding at real different points, so obviously there are very different constituencies in here, and we might all have very different agendas that we're bringing to the discussion. But I come out of the experience in the United States of a very bitter movement, a movement dialogue that has split and is threatening to divide what was originally a very committed, though different, section of feminism and women's liberation. We used to call it women's liberation. So I want to say that some of what I'll be talking about is from the experience of having spent now, somewhat unwillingly, the last 5 years of my life trying to defend a position on the right to talk about sexuality in a setting which basically tended to try and remove my feminism from my right to have that discussion. And I don't think that was an accident. I think in some ways it was a failure of my own socialist feminism in my refusal to deal with issues early on about sexuality. At least in my own history, there was a way I really wanted to spend my time focusing on other kinds of issues rather than sexual issues, issues of sexual abuse, sexual violence, and avoid a lot of the contested terrains about sexuality, not just areas of violence, but all issues of sexuality. There was a way that I was very committed to a left perspective, and I really didn't know how to think about sex, so I just didn't bother. I mean, I thought about it a whole lot in my life, but I didn't talk about it politically. I just obsessed about it all the time. because the other thing I feel like has been true for me, and I suspect true for a lot of different people, is that my own sexual history has often been in violation of my own political ideas. I haven't made love the way I assumed I wanted to when the revolution happened. and that always bothered me a whole lot. And somehow I thought I could just transcend with my mind and my body would follow, and it didn't work like that. And as I began to talk to more and more people, I realized that that was an underlying reality for a lot of women that I knew, and men actually too, although men didn't seem quite so conflicted between the difference in how they felt and how they thought. But since I was more committed to thinking than feeling, more committed to my feelings than my sexuality in some ways. And it began to illuminate for me a very central problem in the idea of trying to apply a political ideology to my sexuality. I had thought that I had it all together and answered and stuff when I came out as a lesbian. That seemed to take care of it, and of course I was extremely righteous about my sexuality in the face of all the straight women I knew that seemed to be dragging around men. So I was, you know, sure that I had found an answer, and so was actually a lot of the assumptions, I think, of feminism at that point. Whether women were heterosexual or homosexual or non-sexual or whatever, there was a kind of assumption that lesbianism did correlate somehow with feminism. But what kind of lesbianism? A lesbianism that was created in the last 15 years or a lesbianism that has a much longer history? When I began to discover the discrepancy between my own desires, even in the lesbian community, for who I wanted and where I looked for my own partners, and the kinds of things that I found going on in the lesbian feminist community, who I was attracted to or I wasn't attracted to, I knew I was really in trouble. Because I've mostly been involved in butch femme relationships, which used to cause people to laugh. That was kind of the response originally, was that it was kind of funny that I was involved with a lot of bar women. And we would come to women's dances and everybody would kind of kid us. But it became much more of a serious issue as butch femme became part of, at least in the United States, a lot of the continuum of sexual deviance that was seen as problematic. Even more, I became committed, though, to trying to work out my own politics around sexuality because I'm an organizer. And because in 1979, there was something in California called the Briggs Initiative, which was an initiative which would have tried to have removed lesbian and gay school teachers and or supporters of lesbian and gay men from the right to teach in all public schools in the state of California. And it was an initiative that was statewide. It superseded any union contracts. It superseded any laws that then existed on the books, and was brought in by a man named John Briggs, who was a little to the right of Reagan, but not far, you know. They're not all very far from each other when one scratches the surface. So some of us began in a desperate attempt to do education to try and counter the knowledge of the kind of terrible fear campaigns that were going on. And those issues came out around sexuality. The kind of campaign that Briggs conducted were like this. Let me put out to you the scenarios of some of the ads that were used. You see a classroom, and the camera is panning the room, and it's a lot of lovely children, 7, 8 years old, probably can't tell quite what. And then it pans up to the front over the heads of the children, but you can still see, you know, their naive little necks and things like that. And it comes to focus not on the physical body of the teacher, who you know from behind a desk, but the hand of the teacher. And the hand of the teacher is an extremely effeminate hand, though the voice is masculine but lispy. And you hear the ad. In the ad, you hear the Briggs people saying, you know, do you want homosexuals to teach in your schools? And then there's a fade down. And then you see the hand moving, talking about geography or something, and you hear the bell go off for the class to end, and then you hear an extremely effeminate male voice say, "Everyone is dismissed except you, Johnny." And then the camera focuses in on a 7-year-old boy. When that's the level of the propaganda that you're dealing with, you don't think you have a lot of chances, but you better get out there and do something. And some of us did go out and do that work, and I did organizing for 2 or 3 months in a van in small cities all through Northern and Southern California, going into small towns, helping lesbians and gay men and their supporters, which were like the 4 Quakers that lived in Northern California, organize in a way that tried, at least, to protect them somewhat, because obviously we all know what it means to be a sexual minority in a small town. The end result of that was that I became much more public about being gay than I had anticipated, because a lot of the people organizing in their own communities could not be the ones to go to the Pinecone Gazette and do an interview about being a lesbian and how I wasn't a pervert and blah, blah. Or I was a pervert, but what was their problem? I wasn't coming to teach in their school. So I ended up being in situations with rooms about as full of people as this or larger debating fundamentalist ministers, because that was the other thing that was going on, was that the new right and the fundamentalist right was organizing in those small towns. Are very powerful. Christian right is very powerful in those places. And they were the major debaters, and they are good. They are extremely good. They are extremely sophisticated. They build their whole economy on their ability to talk you into buying snake oil and things like that. So they're real good about sex, and they're also very good about playing on fear. And that was the setting under which the debates took place. What I began to realize in that situation was that although many of the questions to me were hostile, and I mean they were hostile, you know, what I was dealing with was not so much homophobia as an extraordinarily sexually confused setting where people finally were allowed to ask questions that they'd never been allowed to ask before, and they had absolutely no context to know how to ask them. So that people would accuse me of things as much from them wanting to know as from them hating me. And people would constantly talk to me about how I did it or how I didn't do it or who I did it with or what, you know, whether I used dildos or bananas. I mean, it was an endless kind of variation on a theme. But in truth, there were 2 different things going on. And one was, that seemed very important to me, was to finally air a discussion about homosexuality, but more important to talk about women's sexuality, because that was the other fear that was being played on very deeply in that campaign, i.e., that women were responsible for children's sexuality, and children were their domain. And so women had a primary reason to be concerned about homosexual men in the schools, because they were considered to be the rapists of children. The fact that 96% of all molestation in public schools was done by heterosexual men didn't seem to phase anybody in the debate. No one ever suggested that straight men should leave the teaching profession. But the other thing that happened, of course, was that women were standing up saying, I don't understand sexuality, and I don't understand children's sexuality, and I don't understand my own sexuality. And I began to see that there was really a common thread in that discussion about sex. And as an organizer, that concerned me. And as a obviously, as a woman also caught in that contradiction, it also concerned me, because I didn't know what to say. I didn't have a sexual politics that adequately explained sexuality. I could explain gender. I mean, my feminism helped me explain gender, but it didn't help me explain desire. It didn't really help me talk about why people made the choices they did to partner the way they did or not. And when I couldn't answer that, I really didn't have a lot to say to the, especially to the women that were asking me questions about why I did what I did. I mean, I have always been confused about why I was what I was. So the fact that they were confused too was both reassuring and problematic. And it made me see very clearly too that we bring to all discussions about sexuality whatever class and race we're raised with. So those experiences are described very clearly by the limitations and the possibilities that exist in the communities that you come from. And you can't separate one from the other. So that in a situation that was small and rural and a farm town, the questions had a different kind of meaning than they did in a situation that was more urban, where there were more single women, for instance, and there was more possibility of having jobs, raising children as a single woman, getting a divorce. That didn't have the same meaning. In a rural community, what it meant for a woman to even try and partner with somebody because of how hard it was to meet somebody when you're isolated on a farm had a whole different meaning. So sexuality changed. The whole discussion of sexuality changed by who you could partner with because of who you could meet and who you were allowed to meet and where women were allowed to go. And that those issues began to seem to me to be critical issues, not only about those women's sexuality, about my own sexuality. And I began to feel that far from understanding where to go with that, I had misdirected a lot of my own energy in thinking that the critical edge was pornography. And I began to feel that, in fact, it wasn't that per se, but much more around issues of desire and passion and why we feel it and why we don't, and why it is that so many of us come up blank when we're asked to describe what it is that we want. That began to concern me more than anything else. That was my beginning on this issue. It quickly somehow conflated into a discussion of pornography, because the only way that the issue of sexuality so far had been approached in the feminist movement had been through an exploration of those things that had happened to us, which were horrendous, often in the sexual area. And pornography was seen as only one example of that, as along with battery and so forth. And it became very difficult very quickly to separate out those issues, to say, yes, one is true, but I'm looking over here. Somehow, there became a notion that if one was exploring one thing, one was not adequately dealing with the other. I guess I should just say where coming from now, feel that it's very dangerous to have pornography as an issue isolated from a political movement's analysis in general. And that part of the problem in the feminist movement per se, not just around issues of sexuality, is that we're a very we're a very split up movement, and people do single issue organizing. And when you do single issue organizing, it's very difficult to bring in sets of concerns that are broad and that have an overview and an analysis in general. So if you're doing health organizing, you push around that. If you're doing organizing around battery or rape, you do organizing around that. If you're doing union work, you do that. But it's very difficult to link those issues. I think perhaps one of the reasons the debate has not gotten so strange in Canada is that there's a stronger women's movement, and it hasn't become quite so dichotomized as it has in the United States. I think there's actually a lot more possibility in Canada at this point. Feminism, it seems to me, has lost a lot of ground in the United States. It was an extraordinary movement for a generation of women, and we've passed it down, but it somehow lost an enormous amount of energy and meaning to the women that we've passed it to. Women in the United States that I meet now that are 17 and 18 years old don't know that there was came into a situation where they now have the right for an abortion. They don't remember a time when they didn't. They don't think it's a very important issue. They think that I'm haranguing. Issues of sexuality are very confused issues. A lot of the women that I do a lot of discussing with and debating with think that they can do everything. They're 18 and they think they can do everything. They think that they can combine all aspects of their lives and somehow will come together. The best thing for them is to meet re-entry women that are going back to college at 50 who really do knock that all to hell. And that's helpful. And around the issues of sexuality, women mostly don't know how to talk. And that seems to me the number one thing that's become clear to me. We don't know what we mean when we talk about what we want. I once did a workshop where it was very conflicted and people were fighting and screaming. So we stopped it. People were accusing each other of like bad sex attitudes, you know. You do it wrong and you do it right and I don't do it right at all and fuck all of you. And you know, it was mean, nasty fight. And it was getting worse because it was 50 people. So you know, the energy level goes up really quickly. It flares really fast and everybody's buttons was being pushed. So we stopped it. I stopped it because I was supposed to be responsible for it and I could see that it was going to be death on the line. And we reorganized it so that we had 2 hours, 50 people, all women, sat in a circle, and each woman had to say something about her own sexuality or her own sexual desires. She could say anything she wanted. The choice was totally open, but there was not a choice to not say anything, and there was not a choice to not talk about sex. You could talk about anything you wanted to. I mean, you could talk about anything you wanted to, but you could not talk. You could leave, but you could not talk. If it was supposed to be a discussion of sexuality and sexual difference, then we were going to find out whether that was a true notion or not. 2 hours later, having listened to 50 different people say something unpredictable about their sexuality, the concept of difference had a material meaning in that room that never would have happened if I'd been trying to give a talk on divergence and difference and how women experience their sexuality different depending on where they come from. We'd sat and looked from each face, and each of us had obviously categorized every single other person sexually in that room. I mean, I had, for sure I had figured out what every, you know, I mean, you do. You sit and look at someone, you say, well, she's this or she's that or she does this or she, you know, I mean, I had my own fantasies going and I wasn't right very often. And none of us were. One of the nicest things was a woman that ran in and sat down and said, I'm sorry I'm late, but I just slept with a woman for the first time, so I thought, the current time, nobody knew what to do with it. You know, she didn't know what to do with it. We didn't know what to do with it. It just, you know, kind of rolled around the room. It made me think that the issue of pornography isolated from a political movement that has a wider analysis of women's oppression is a dangerous thing, because looking at what is sexually explicit without understanding women's sexuality and women's responses, very mixed responses to sexuality, becomes the problem itself. That none of us know what we're looking at when we're looking. I mean, it would be interesting to me to know how many women in this room have spent much time, either for pleasure or for politics, looking at porn. Mostly, in my experience of doing this kind of talking, most of us haven't. And if we have, if we've been introduced to it at all, it's been through the anti-pornography movement, and that's a very particular way to learn about pornography. Whether or not, I mean, let me say to you for one thing that I think videos, whatever we think or not think, are changing the sexual life of North America. I actually think that that's the number one sexual change that's going on in the 80s. And that it is not an accident that video shops are opening up in every small town and that women are buying and using them an enormous amount, not just men. Lesbians that I know of, and even straight women that I know of, who I would never assume would go to a porn shop, go to a video shop, and ask for number 34. There really is a different thing that's happening because of it, and I think we have to try and think about that as image makers ourselves and what that means and whether we intend to intervene in it. Primarily, I guess what I want to say is that the important issues to me seem to be around the discussions that we need to have and explore about what constitutes a woman's sexuality. And that before we've had that discussion, to focus on pornography as a major organizing tool, as though the removal of pornography would radically affect most women's lives, seems to me is very wrong, very dangerous, and leads to the kind of political polarization and the possibility of things like feminist support of censorship that I think will only, you know, endanger us an extraordinary amount, and it terrifies me. One of the things that I've seen happen in a lot of what I consider in the United States the move to the right in the anti-pornography movement is an extraordinary reevaluation and re-romanticization of the family. In my own analysis, the family is a kind of the root cause of the problems of women, along with capitalism. I think it's kind of basic. And so the defense of the family and the idea that pornography is the problem between men and women seems to, which is quite a lot of the argument, that it is pornography itself that is not just a reflection but a root cause of women's oppression. That's a dangerous argument, and an argument that doesn't help us separate out what it is that we object to in a sexually explicit situation and what it is that we don't know how to look at. And if we're going to figure out for ourselves how to talk about change and our own sexuality and re-empower ourselves, it seems to me that we need to listen to each other an enormous amount more. We need to look at every image we can get our hands on. We need to find out from other women what they see in those images, not just what we see, because believe me, it's different. It's extraordinarily different. There is not one female response to an image that's sexually explicit. And what it is then that we want to take from those things that are sexually explicit and repossess, and what it is in them that are sexist or racist or homophobic and which we want to have no part of. But until we can begin to discuss amongst ourselves those things that we want to own in our own sexuality, that we want to create, that we want to have power through, we're in a dangerous position when we make assumptions about what it means that women fuck the way they do. We are, it seems to me, in a terrible place where women could potentially, the new feminist response could potentially decide in a new way that there's a morality that women must adhere to, which somehow describes for them their sexuality and polarizes it. And then, if that happens, women will choose not to join us. And I don't choose to be in a movement that forces women outside of the boundaries of feminism in order to explore their sexuality.